This is our Youth Conference, California, 2013. Our speaker is Brother Jim Stiles. His topic for this series is Return of the Exiles. And the title for this class is Esther and Nehemiah. Brother Jim.
Thanks for that. Hope you're all a little bit awake still at the end of the week. All right, a little bit. I hope yesterday that going through the end of Esther and looking at the end of Ezra and Ezra chapters 9 and 10, it's easy to get distracted by the divorce issue when you're reading through those chapters and miss the main point. And I hope nobody walked away without at least looking at and examining the main point of those two chapters is that we've got to be careful who we choose as our spouses in the truth. We really do. We get a lot of counsel from God about this is a super important decision that you make as a young person. The way God set us up in families and as young people, you grow up and through your teenage years, you start looking around at who the possibilities are. And sometimes even in our teens or in our 20s, we all of a sudden we pick our spouse for life. That's a really critical time to be making that kind of a decision. But God's done it in such a way that we make that decision and have to trust him then for the rest of our lives on choices that we've made. And we do have to be very careful. And as you saw in that story yesterday in Ezra at the end, and then you'll see it again in Nehemiah, that this became a huge problem in the community to where you've got to be careful. If you're looking forward to the future and you want to make sure that you have a spouse who will assist you in your walk in the truth and who will help you in raising children up to God, godly children, you've got to be very careful who you pick as your spouse. You want to find a believer who is number one committed to God. And then things work out after that. But that really is the key critical issue at the end of both Ezra and Nehemiah. This became a problem in the community consistently going on through. Now, yesterday we ended up looking at a little bit of time at least and looking at Esther. Make sure I remember when we quit today. Did we quit at 9? Is that right? I'm starting to lose track at the end of the week, Jason, of when we start and stop. I should look before we start. Oh, I have a book. 9 o'clock. All right. Got to make sure I quit on time. All right. So, because you've got to get those projects done today, we have to present tonight. So, is it 9:15? Is that what it is? Oh, okay. Thank you very much. All right. So, Esther's obedience. When you actually examine how Esther, in the story of Esther, it's easy to read the story of Esther and sometimes walk away discouraged because there's really no references to God in the book, no direct references. They're all sort of indirect references that reference God, and it's more like an innuendo or some kind of an implied kind of a concept as to what's actually happening at that time. But when you have a look at what's actually going on in the story, you can see that there are some key issues brought up in the story of Esther that are probably worth Bible marking, or at least coloring, or in some way making a note about what's happening in the story. You look at one of the things that comes out very clearly is Esther's obedience. That comes out as you're reading through the account and you realize how she's obedient to the king, as opposed to Vashti's disobedience is the way that's presented. And then the decree goes out that all wives honor their husbands. And so you look at, that's one issue with Esther. You find her obedience to Haggai. She's willing to take the suggestions that Haggai gives her, and she goes in before the king with exactly what Haggai said. And that's all she does, is follow what he said. Or her obedience to Mordecai, her cousin in this case, where she obeyed the command as when she was brought up by him. And I think that's a fun concept to look at in this story because obedience to God was one of those key issues that had caused the captivity. That's why they were up there in the first place, is because they had failed to be obedient to their God. And in this story then, Esther, as representing the bride of Christ, represents to all of us the obedience that she gives to the people that she's working with. Look at the preparations that she made to go in before the king. You ever wondered as you're reading through this story, why is this stressed over and over again? Why does it tell you all the details about what she went through and how long they prepared doing these things? If it wasn't to illustrate a concept to all of us that when we go to meet our king, we have to be prepared. You find that you're looking at Revelation 19 next year. You're going to find that the bride had prepared herself. That's what's there in Revelation 19 when the bride comes to meet the Lord Jesus Christ. And so you'll see the references in chapter 2 at verse 3, let the maidens get beauty treatments. And you wonder, oh, why are they talking this about beauty treatments here in the Bible? If it isn't to stress the preparations, not so much the idea of the beauty treatments and the beauty pageant going on. And so Haggai, in chapter 2, verse 9, Haggai gave Esther the beauty treatments and the special food that she went through. In chapter 2 and verse 12, she had to complete 12 months of beauty treatments. 6 months, it tells you, with the oil of myrrh, and then 6 months with perfumes and cosmetics. So it's giving us all this detail about what she goes through, and I'm really certain God isn't just trying to tell us about how she just made herself beautiful. He's trying to illustrate a concept through what was going on. See, it's very much like when you were looking at Melchizedek last night, and you're studying Melchizedek, and you find out like he represents the king-priest aspect, you know, about a one that would come beyond the law of Moses, who would actually operate as king-priest. You go back and you wonder, like, where did Paul get all that from when he's talking about Melchizedek? How did that come out in Psalm 110 about Melchizedek, the idea that there would be a king and priest? And you go back to the Genesis record and you find out there's this little story recorded about Melchizedek. And you read the story and you wonder, like, what's that doing there when Abraham comes back from defeating Lot? And you find out that when people study the Bible and they read the Bible, when our New Testament commentaries record, when they give us what they know about the Bible, Paul says it's not so much the incident about Melchizedek, but it's the way it is recorded. The way it is recorded, he says, did you notice how the way the Bible was written? When Melchizedek shows up on the scene, it doesn't say anything about his mom and dad, and it doesn't say anything about when he died. He just shows up, and there he is. And Paul says it was written that way to illustrate a concept so that you would understand that he was going to represent the one who was without human father, and he would go on without end. And that's why it was written that way. And so you start looking at things like that in the story of Esther, that the way the Bible records the story is to teach us about the principles. And you find that the king loved Esther and she received grace and favor. And so God was trying to remind the captives through this story that if you are preparing to meet your king, you've got to prepare like Esther did. I think one of the big reasons this is in here, and this is what can help convince me that the story of Esther really does belong in the Bible, because some people actually challenge whether it really belongs in the scriptures at all. They look at this story and they say there's no reference to God, and it's just like it's written like it was like a bunch of political Zionists who are just like Jewish people, and they just care about their community. But when you examine what the story is about and how Mordecai triumphs over Amalek, then you start seeing, wow, look at the connections to the scriptures all over the place. You find out that Haman is an Agagite. He comes from Agag's line, and Agag came from the Amalekites. You can trace that back through. And those of you that were at kids camp last week, you remember how God said that he will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. And so it started with the Exodus, and it ends all the way at the end of the Old Testament. He's still fighting with Amalek, which represented the battle with sin. And he promised to wipe out the remembrance of Amalek. And the war was still going on all the way through this period. Remember how Saul had spared Agag? Remember that story? And he spared Agag. And Samuel comes in and he hacks him to pieces. And this is what was going on still as God was warring with Amalek. Remember how Haman in this story, he wanted to kill all the Jews. They call him the people of Mordecai. See, now that's the way it's recorded. It's the people of Mordecai. Because in this story, although we call it the story of Esther, what the story is really about is Mordecai's triumph over Haman. It was about how God promised that he would overcome Amalek. He would overcome sin and that his son would triumph. And Mordecai represented the Lord Jesus Christ in this story. And it was his people that he was out to save. And certainly Esther was a part of that salvation, but it was Mordecai who was motivating it as it's going through the story. And in the end, Haman is hung in chapter 7 at verse 10. And then Haman's 10 sons are killed and hung on the gallows as well. And Esther, in the end, receives all of Haman's house. And you start looking at how these things are recorded because they meant a lot more than just the initial story. Because God had promised he would defeat sin. You can watch as you run through this story of how Mordecai's elevation comes along and it's building up to the point where Mordecai is finally put up there and he's almost like right next to the king, predicting the elevation of the Lord Jesus Christ, who would be there elevated and sit down at the right hand of the majesty on high. He gets the king's signet ring in chapter 8, verses 1 through 2, and he's appointed over Haman's house. You know, that is, it reminds you of those passages we were looking at last night, that he must reign until he has put all his enemies under his feet. And this actually happened with Haman, with Mordecai and with Haman. Remember, he wrote the decree in chapter 8 and verse 9 to save all the Jews from annihilation. He saved the whole household of the Jews, which is what our Lord Jesus Christ would do. The Gentiles became fearful of Mordecai, for he was in a prominent position in the palace, and his reputation spread, you find in chapter 9 at verse 4. And Mordecai finally writes the decree for the annual celebration of Purim in chapter 9. And then you have the summary of the elevation of Mordecai the Jew in chapter 10. See, this story really was all about the elevation of Mordecai, predicting what God would do through his son. If people trusted him, that he would bring about a savior who would redeem all of his people. And you certainly see as you're running through the story of Esther, you can see how people who trusted God put their faith into action. It wasn't just an academic faith. It wasn't just some kind of cultural thing. These people put their lives on the line in order to save God's people. You saw how Esther's faith and her trust somehow in becoming queen was part of that plan. She looked back over her life, and so did Mordecai, and ended up saying, wow, look at how God has brought you through the events of this life, and he's put you in this position now so that you can help out at a critical time. And so you saw with Esther her willingness to go in before the king, and she says, if I perish, I perish. And she's willing to trust whatever God brings about. Reminds you a lot, doesn't it, of the three friends of Daniel when they went in and they just said, look, our God can save us when you throw us into the fire. But, you know, if we perish, we perish. Whatever God decides will be the right thing. And she had that kind of a faith. And the banquets that Esther went through, you wonder, like, why does it give you all the detail about this plan that she comes up? And it's to help us understand that this is what faith does in people. You develop a plan, you pray to God for your help, for his help in making it work, and then you trust God to make it work out. And you'll see that happen in faithful people all over the scriptures. As the proverb says, to trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not on your own understanding, but in all your ways you acknowledge him and he will direct your paths. He will. He promises to do that. And so you see faith in action in these people. And look at how it became an effective witness. Because these people led faithful lives, they were able to let other people see this. Gentiles saw the results of their lives, and the Jews were certainly full of happiness and joy and great honor in chapter 8, verse 17. But many Gentiles were attracted to the Jewish community because they saw what their God was doing for them. Very similar to when all the plagues came on Egypt and the Jewish community came out of Egypt. They came out a mixed multitude because some of the Egyptians were starting to realize that Yahweh, the God of the Jews, he really was a powerful God. And we better find out about him. And they were drawn to him. Very much the way later on in the story of Ruth. You see that with Ruth. And she was just drawn to the fact that Naomi's God was something that changed Naomi's life. And so this became an effective witness in the sense, in the same way that the Lord Jesus Christ would be later on. And then there was certainly the warning coming out to the captives at this time. Remember Zechariah 2? Get out of Babylon. Get out while you can. This comes next. All right, this is what happened for all of the Jews that didn't leave Babylon and come down. All those Levites that didn't really want to come with Ezra yesterday when we were looking at that story. God gave them a push and said, you better get out while you can. Come on back down to your land where at least you're safe from the Hamans. And so he motivates them to get out of the land of Babylon, and he gives them that gentle push. So you look at why God raised up Haman, why that whole story is even there. Why does this come up about this whole plan to annihilate the Jews? This was the angel's way of pushing people in a certain direction. And sometimes it takes some pretty drastic things. You may not have realized, but you're reading through the Acts of the Apostles, and remember how nasty and drastic and devastating the death of Stephen was? You know, that if you were a Jew living at that time, and here's your Stephen, who was such a faithful person, and he's out there talking to the Jews, he would have been like one of your leaders, and he's out there, and he's dealing with the Jews, and they stoned him. And you'd go away devastated. How could God let that happen? You know, our great friend and our leader and somebody who was helping our cause. And they stoned him dead. And then you find out that the angels had a plan. Because Stephen was dead and the Jews were afraid, what they did is they scattered all over the empire. They left Jerusalem finally. And the angels were trying to push them out of Jerusalem and go out and take the message throughout the earth. And who would have known that when you were standing there watching the event? And yet, this is how angels get things done. This is how they get involved in our lives. And so you find how God had promised to bless their economy and their food. And back in Haggai, when we were looking at that, if they would get back to the land and get to work. He promised to protect their cities in Zechariah 2. And he promises in chapter 2 of Zechariah to dwell in their midst if they would simply come out of her and be his people. So from the story of Esther, you can get a lot of these good lessons that you can actually pull out of Esther, that God is working in our lives. He is in control, but very much like that time, he's doing it behind the scenes today. There's no angels walking in the door talking to you. We don't have prophets who can speak by God's spirit, but they didn't either at that time. And when these people with Esther and Mordecai, they're making decisions based on faith. And they just had to believe with the eye of faith and see God working in their lives. But we do need to prepare now to meet our king. This is our opportunity to get ready as Esther got ready to meet the king. And faith and obedience are critical parts of joining God's family. And we have to practice them every day. And our way of life, our faithful way of life, when we tell people back home, at school, and around our jobs, and in our neighborhoods, we tell them what we're doing, some of them will be drawn to find out what it is that motivates us to live the way we do. And that became an effective witness back then. And certainly God's war with Amalek comes out of this story, and he's encouraging all of us to join the war. Get involved in this war with Amalek, and get out of Babylon before it's too late. That's the warning that he leaves for us. Oh, yes, Jason. So we don't want to forget about the used book sale, right? And remember, we're going to read those books for the love of the little child, right? Now, when you move into the story of Nehemiah, I wish we had more time really to look at Nehemiah, but we got Nehemiah and we got Malachi to look at this one today, so or Malachi, as you if you read up in Strong's as to how it's pronounced. But we'll look at Nehemiah at least this morning for this class, and then maybe a little bit in the second class. We'll see how it goes. Hopefully, some of you had a chance to look at the story of Nehemiah, either when doing the workbook, or some of you were doing it here while you were here this week. And there really are great lessons in this story of Nehemiah. Nehemiah, when you look at what he did, he was a tremendous motivator. He was the kind of person that could come into your group and get you to do things that you really didn't want to do, didn't think you could do. He'd be like a camp leader who would get out there tomorrow morning and motivate the camp leader. He'd motivate your group to, like, take down the tent. Let's clean up all this stuff. Let's get it all packed away. The big truck's going to be here, and let's get it in the truck. And we're going to need some motivators tomorrow to do that kind of thing. That's what Nehemiah was like. He's the kind of guy that could walk in a friendly way and get everybody working for him. He did set a standard for the community. He set a high standard for them, and he expected them to stick to that. He did it himself, and he asked them to do it as well. And he's a great example of leadership and commitment in ecclesial life. We really need Nehemiahs. We need them in our CYCs. We need them in our ecclesias. We need them in our community because they provide an example for us to follow, and they're committed people, and they get us going. They give us that push that we need sometimes to get involved in God's work. And he had a huge impact on the spiritual lives of these people. And he was willing to deal with problems. When something rose up and there was a problem in the ecclesia, he didn't just walk out the door and say, well, let somebody else handle it. He dealt with the problems like Ezra did yesterday that we were looking at. But it's fun to watch that Nehemiah's strategy in dealing with problems was a little different than Ezra's. Ezra would come in and he would sit down and he'd cry and he'd be with the people. Nehemiah would walk in and he'd come in and he'd pull out your hair and beat some of them. And he's a different person. And it's fun to watch that concept that we have these different personalities in the truth, in our ecclesias, in our CYCs, and God uses them both. He uses both in order to motivate his people. And Nehemiah is that kind of leader. So when you look at where we are in the timeline when Nehemiah shows up, you find out that Nehemiah shows up over here in the 20th year of Artaxerxes. 20th year, who's probably the same fella, Darius Hystaspes, that we've been looking at, or Darius, and he's now in the 20th year. So Ezra had come in the 6th year, and now about 14 years has gone by since Ezra has shown up in the land, and Ezra has been working for 14 years. So it really wasn't that long a period before Nehemiah shows up on the scene. So when he's actually considering coming down there at this point, the book starts out in this 20th year of Artaxerxes. You find out that he's a pretty high up person in the government. He's the cupbearer of the king. He would be the kind of person that he wouldn't be some little scrawny guy. They wouldn't pick him to be the cupbearer. The cupbearer would be some guy who's like fairly big and bulky and fairly healthy person. And as being the cupbearer, many times you would drink the wine first before you gave it to the king to guarantee that it wasn't poison. And so the king wouldn't want to have a cupbearer who was already not in very good shape or a pretty scrawny guy. You'd want some big, healthy guy, and you'd figure, wow, if he drops dead, I'm not drinking the wine. And so that's probably gives us some hints, at least, about what Nehemiah would have been like. And so he asks Hananiah, he asks him about the surviving captives, and he was probably Nehemiah's brother. And he finds out they're in great distress at this point. It's only 14 years Ezra's been back in the land. But things aren't progressing. Ezra's got the temple, you know, there. He's working in the temple. But it's like the people finished the project, and a lot of them just went back to the problems that Haggai had described for us that we were looking at. They went back to working on their own homes and got back to those kind of things. They didn't just keep going and now work on the walls. They just let it all go. So he comes back, and he's mourning and fasting, the same kind of thing that Ezra would do. And then he asks for the king. He's going to go in and ask, and he's brave in a sense. He's courageous. It's like the hymn we sing, the camp song, to stand strong and be firm and be courageous. And he does. He takes that kind of approach. Now, look at the prayer that Nehemiah gives, and remember how Ezra prayed as well. And I think you find a lot from these prayers. It's really nice in the scriptures sometimes that God has given us prayers of faithful people. So you can read through Daniel 9, and you can actually see this man of prayer, Daniel. What did he really say in his prayers? Or you can look at Ezra's prayer, and you can see the kind of things that Ezra prayed for, or in this case, with Nehemiah. And what you find consistently with leaders when they talk to God, that the leaders don't gripe about them, those people that are making all this mistake. You know, fix them. Instead, they go to God and they say, we've got a problem. You know, they are in there in the problem. They're involved in their community. And they see themselves as part of this. And so he prays to the God of heaven, the awesome God, he calls him. You who keep your covenant and mercy with those who love you and observe your commandments, please. You know, a lot of Bible versions, they don't do this. They don't even put in words like please. You ever notice that, the please and thank yous? But some of them realize that in the Hebrew and the Greek sometimes, these are implied concepts that we would use in English. And this is how he talks to God. Please let your ear be attentive and your eyes open, that you may hear the prayer of your servant, which I pray before you now, day and night, for the children of Israel, your servants, and confess the sins of the children of Israel, which we have sinned against you. Both my father's house and I have sinned. See, this is how he sees himself in the problem. And we've acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, nor the ordinances which you commanded your servant Moses. And I really think when you examine those prayers of the Bible characters who were the great leaders of the community, they are always including themselves in with the problem. It's not like I'm here and the problem's over there and talk all about them to God. It's that we have a problem. We have acted corruptly. And that's why they became great leaders. That's part of that component. So he prays in this case. Remember, I pray, the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, if you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though some of you were cast out of to the farthest parts of the heavens, yet I will gather them from there and bring them to the place which I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. Now these are your servants and your people whom you've redeemed by your great power and your strong hand. O Lord, I pray, please let your ear be attentive to the ear of your servants and to the prayer of your servants who desire to fear your name. And let your servant prosper this day, I pray, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. So here we go again with another Bible character who's wanting to operate by faith, put his faith into action, and he comes up with a plan. No angel showed up and told him what to do. He developed a plan based on what he thought would be a good thing for the community. And then he goes to God and says, please, please prosper this plan. And you'll find that consistent about Nehemiah all the way through. And that's all God expects out of us today. You go home. You get involved in your ecclesias. You come up with ideas that you think might be helpful to your CYCs, your Sunday schools, your ecclesias. And you pray for God's blessing. And you hope that he will bless the pathway that you have chosen. And if he doesn't, then we start and we analyze, well, maybe that's not the right thing at this time. And then we look for something else. But in this case, you can see how God prospered his plan. And he knew he was going to need God's mercy. Now, for any of you that read details and you're wondering, like, how this could ever happen, that Nehemiah, when you look at what happens in this story, that we're told that it's in the 20th year of the king. And he comes and Hanani brings the news to him, and it tells you specifically when it was in this ninth month in Kislev right here. And then you wonder, if you go across the Jewish calendar, you find out on the first month, which is Nisan, that's when he goes in before the king. You might be wondering, like, how can it still be the 20th year? But you got to remember, it's the 20th year of Artaxerxes, and so the Jewish calendar is clicking over, but it's still his 20th year. And so this is not some kind of like Bible inconsistency. This is just recording it, and you're keeping track of the differences between the Jewish calendar and the Persian calendar in this case. So he's going to go then before the king right here in the month of Nisan right here in the first month of the Jewish calendar. And then we know that he then returns to Israel during this period, and he gets the people motivated, and in 52 days it's finished. And it's all done in this case before the seventh month and the Day of Atonement. So this is all going to happen in a real quick period of time. It's fast, this whole story with Nehemiah. So when you look at his faith as to how it comes across in this story, he can't hide his sadness before the king. He can't. He's dreadfully afraid of how the king might react to his sadness. You can imagine how Esther, when she went in before the king, I'm sure the king realized in this case that she was a little bit spooked out about what she was doing. But God prospered their work. And this is what you have to look at in your life. You create a pathway, you go ahead and you make decisions, and you pray for God's help. This is the strategy that all these Bible characters consistently use. And God's trying to tell us that this is what he wants us to do. He wants us to create a plan for our life. You have to make decisions. We just can't go home and sit there and wait for it to come into our head about what we're supposed to do. That isn't going to happen. You don't have spirit gifts. We don't have angels talking to us. So you go home, and on the way home, you think about, what can you do in your ecclesia? What can you do in your CYC this fall to make a difference? And then you pray for God's help, that he will prosper. Or you decide about big decisions in your life. You know, what school you're going to go to, what job you're going to take on, what ecclesia you're going to belong to, who you're going to look for to marry. These are the big decisions, and you have to make those decisions and pray for God's blessing upon them. That's what we do. We pray for his guidance. But so often the answers are through God's providence, as they were in these stories. And I really think, for myself at least, this was really encouraging to see, and going through this whole period of history, because so often as a younger person, we wish, I just wish I could talk to an angel for 5 minutes. You wish a prophet would walk in the door and tell us what to do, because we want to do God's will. We want to. But we don't know what it is. And that's the way it's been for so many people down through the ages. It's only the rare cases where actually a prophet did walk in the door or an angel did appear. Most of God's family throughout all of history in 6,000 years, most of them never saw an angel and they never heard a prophet. It's you go back and look at these stories, and this is what happened. They heard of it secondhand, maybe, but they didn't get to see the angels, and they didn't get to hear the prophets. And yet they still made really good choices and decisions. So he tells the king about the sad conditions when the king realizes he's sad, and the king responds, "What do you need?" And this is how angels operate. They work in the situation and in areas before the king. And, you know, the queen's sitting there with him. And you can imagine how the angels would be sitting there and say, "Oh, look at how this worked out. We've got Esther now. She's sitting there with the king. And there she is, you know, and Nehemiah goes in before her. And Esther's having an impact in this whole story. Still, I really think, as you go through this whole process, she was involved with Haman. She's now involved with Nehemiah. And that's why it says the queen was sitting beside him. Otherwise, why would that be in our record? Why would God tell us that the queen was sitting there if it wasn't because it's Esther and she's going to have an impact? And this is how God puts the right people in the right place at the right time. And so he tells the king about how long he's going to be gone. He ends up being gone for 12 years in this case. And then he has to report back to the king. And any additional requests? So it shows you Nehemiah had thought this out. He's not the kind of person who just like spontaneously goes in and says, "Oh, we'll go on the fly." No, he's got it out. He knows what his plan. He's worked out ahead of time. He's made the preparations, and he's organized. And so he's going to get these letters to the governors allowing him to pass through. And he wants a letter to Asaph for timber, for the temple and the wall and the house and different things. This is what he does. He makes preparations. And so the king sent the army and the captains and the horsemen with Nehemiah, and away they go, and he carries out the plan. But look at what happens as they go along. Chapter 2, they just get started. It's very similar to Ezra, isn't it? They come here and they build an altar, and the people of the land hear the shouting going on, and then they come in and say, oh, we want to help too, right? So in chapter 2, when Sanballat the Horonite, he's a foreigner, Tobiah the Ammonite, he's a foreigner, official, heard of it, they were deeply disturbed that a man had come to seek the well-being of the children of Israel. Oh, can't you see the animosity that was there? These people here, oh, they remember a few years ago when they had to pay all those taxes. And the Persian army told them to stay away from the building of the temple. And there's this animosity that had just swelled up over this 10, 15-year period right now. And they're just, oh, not again. Somebody's coming back from the Persian Empire. And here they are seeking the well-being of these Israelites. And here we go again. And that's what happens in life. So you go home and you decide you're going to get involved in CYC and you're going to have a project, you're going to try something. It doesn't always go smooth. Sometimes you face opposition like that. Sometimes there are some problems and you just have to get through those problems and trust that God will help you through. So this is what happens in this case. Right away he meets the opposition. So if you're wondering about Sanballat right there, he was a Horonite, the way he's described. He was probably from Beth Horon in Ephraim right here, and he was one of these Samaritans. So you can see why in this case he would have this kind of opposition. He came from the background of these Samaritans who had been the adversaries back in Ezra. He was like one of those characters that was sitting there in Zechariah 3 when the Satan was there before Joshua. It's possible him or maybe his parents were involved in like some of the opposition that went on when they were trying to build the temple. He ends up being related in the end to Eliashib, the high priest. By the time this story progresses, you can see that what's happening in the community is the standards are dropping. The leaders are making terrible decisions. So that you remember back when we started with Jeshua, the high priest, he has a son, Joiada, and now we're into Eliashib. He's the third generation down. He's be the grandchild, in this case, of the faithful high priest, Jeshua. And now time has passed, and Jeshua's dead. And now Eliashib has taken over as the high priest. And in the end, he makes a deal, and he ends up becomes related by marriage to Sanballat, of all people. And involved in the mixed marriages in the end of Nehemiah. So then you've got Tobiah. He's probably an Ammonite official in this case, as he's described, which may mean that he's a slave of the Persian king. And then there's Geshem the Arab, the Arabian in this case, in Nehemiah 6, who also comes in. And all three of these fellows are going to cause a lot of trouble for Nehemiah. They're going to try all the different techniques they can to try to stop this work. They are great intimidators. They're the kind of people that try to intimidate you into stopping the work. And you'll see that as the story plays out. Now, look at Nehemiah's strategy to motivate the people. What he does is he goes out and he first surveys the situation. He's an organized person. This is what leadership has. You have organizational skills. So he doesn't just come in and say, well, I think we ought to build the walls. He goes out, first of all, and rides around at night. Right? Didn't want anybody to know the plan. So he's making his plans without getting everybody all riled up. And he rides around at night and he surveys how big the project's going to be. So he's got some details about what are you thinking of doing. And this is what you'd have to do in your CYCs and in your ecclesias. You got to go out and do your research. You got to figure out what's the plan. So that when people start asking questions, you can say, all right, I've looked at this and looked at that. And you've got a general idea of what the plan is going to be. Then he gets the people together and explains the plan to the people. He lays out his whole plan to rebuild the walls. And then what he does is he brings God into the picture. And he tries to explain to the people that look at how God has blessed us so far. God's given us permission to do this. We've got Esther up there as the queen. And we've got an opportunity, a window has opened up with the king to get this project done. The king's given us his blessing. That would have been very encouraging to those people. And the people respond in this case, let's go. Let's get out there and arise and build. And it's fun to watch how Nehemiah comes in and encourages his ecclesia to get involved. And I really think that's a good model for all of us in our CYCs and our ecclesias about how we get projects going. We don't just come in and tell everybody, now we got to do this, and you know, what's the problem? Why haven't we been doing it? You don't come in with a negative attitude. You come in and we explain, look at, God will bless this project. Look at the resources he's given us. You have a scope, an idea of what the project is going to entail, and it's positive, positive, positive. That's what you see in Nehemiah, and the people get motivated to work with him. He would have been a fun person to work with, really a fun person in ecclesial life. So as they get going, the opposition makes its first move. Nehemiah 2, verses 19 and 20. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official and Geshem the Arab heard of it, they laughed at us and they despised us. And they said, what is this thing that you are doing? Will you rebel against the king? Oh, doesn't that sound familiar? Remember what the adversaries tried to do back in the time of Ezra? They write the letter to the king. If you let them finish these walls, even though it was only the temple, they're going to rebel against the king. So this is what the opposition always does. They create a story. They create a plan that's going to make it look like you're rebelling against the king. And then they hope the king will come in and shut them down. But see how Nehemiah responds? He doesn't give an inch. He doesn't give an inch on this because he says, look it, our God has supported this project. He's got confidence in his God, and those people have no right to be involved or to stop this project. The building on this project, this would have been tough. Maybe a little harder even than the temple building that went on before. This would have been a tough project because they had to clear out all of the junk. Because when the Babylonians had come in, they just knocked down the walls, and all the stones were still sitting there. So somebody had to, first of all, clear out all the junk and then clean it all up and find out how they could put this wall back together. This was going to be hard work and need a lot of people involved all at one time. If you ever have a look at this whole concept of what went on in the building of the walls of Jerusalem in the days of Nehemiah, I remember as a younger person thinking that it was probably what you would see up in here in this picture, that these walls right here. But the more I've looked into it, it seems like most people are convinced that they probably built this area right in here. If you look at Lean Rittmeyer's book, Brother Lean Rittmeyer, he wrote one on Jerusalem in the time of Nehemiah, and he went with the smaller wall concept as well. It was not as big a project as sometimes we anticipate it as, but nobody really knows for sure. It's just it seems as though they went with the smaller project. What it did is it came down further into the city of David right in here, and it has this little area that comes down close to what we would call the Valley of Hinnom down in there where the Dung Gate was. And it's possible that that's all that they actually put together. It really wasn't a very big, enclosed area here. It was actually pretty small. But it was very defensible because you might look at that and say, well, how could you ever defend an area like this right here and there? It's so narrow. But if you look at pictures of Jerusalem, what would happen after you had the wall is that the slope would go down like that so that you could easily defend the area because the invading army was going to have to run like up a cliff. They're going to run up a steep hill in order to get up there at that time. So that's why it's possible that that was a defendable position. But that's something you can have a look at as you, do your own research. I know some of the kids here this week were researching that, and it's hard to figure out which wall they actually built. I think what is important to us is that when you look at the builders, what they actually did in building on the wall, you find out that most of the workers in chapter 3, if you look at the specifics of what's actually happening there, they went and they built the gates and wall sections. That was tough. It was one thing to build a wall. It was a whole other thing to build a gate. Gates were tough to put up at that time, and they did. And there was they repaired up there on the northern walls. The Tekoites, they did their section in verse 5. Did you notice, though, they also come up in verse 27? They're the kind of people that after they finish their project, they didn't just sit there and say, we're done. How's the work going today? They jumped in and got involved in another section of the wall. They were faithful workers. They wanted to get the job done. It's interesting to watch that there were faithful Gibeonites working on the wall. I find that fascinating that when you go back and look at that ecclesial decision back in Joshua 9, where they could have made the decision to try to kill all the Gibeonites for lying to them. They left them alive, they prayed about it before God, and they said, all right, we're not going to make another mistake to fix the first mistake. And instead, they left them in the community as slave laborers. And you find out that some of those Gibeonites were really attracted to the community and became faithful members of the community. And in this case, they were still working in Nehemiah 3 at verse 7. You got Shallum and his daughters that were working on the wall. You don't see a whole lot of that. But there were some women who got involved. This fellow got his daughters involved. Maybe he didn't have any sons. But they were helping him and working on the wall. So for all of you girls out there that just thought this was a guy-only project, oh no, you could get involved too. And I imagine there were plenty of things for the girls to do besides just bringing them more food all the time. You could get involved in the work. Melchijah, the son of Rechab. That sound familiar for all of you that know about the Rechabites? Remember the Rechabites that came from all the way back from the story with Hobab, which was Moses' wife's brother? And when they came out of Egypt and Hobab joined them and Moses said, "Won't you come with us? Won't you be our eyes when we're going through the wilderness?" You know, this was a fellow who was Zipporah's brother, the son of Jethro. And Moses said, "Please go with us." And it doesn't tell us whether he went or not. But later on in the record, you find that Hobab's descendants are linked in with the community of Israel. And as you travel through the records of the Old Testament, you can actually trace them right on through to this time. They became part of the Hobab's descendants. He had a fellow named Kenaz, and the Kenazites were there in the time period of the Judges. And you find out, they tell you where they came from, that they were way back from Hobab's family. And as you travel through and you find out the Kenites, what they did is they didn't just get incorporated into the community of Israel and join them totally. They sort of stayed separate. They put up their tents. And they were involved in the community, but they were a little bit hesitant to jump right in because the Israelites became unfaithful so often. And so they would sort of stay separate from the community, sometimes separate too much. Because remember the story in the Judges where Jael killed Sisera? Jael was married to one of the Kenazites, one of these descendants of Hobab. And then as you travel on through the record, you find out that these people were the ones that Jeremiah was told to bring in before the community. Now, remember in Jeremiah's message that the Babylonians had come in and they surrounded the city. And so you'd look outside the city walls, there were Babylonians all around. They were trapped. And God tells Jeremiah, he says, bring in some of these people that are descendants of Rechab. And Rechab was one of these Kenazites. He was one of these descendants from down through Hobab. And he said to Jeremiah, he said, bring him in front of the community, in front of the leaders. Now, these people weren't used to being with the leaders. They were like nomads. They usually stayed out in tents, like out there, and they didn't get involved in all of this Israelitist, government and all these leaders and all that. But the only reason they were in Jerusalem is because the Babylonians had come in and surrounded the city. So they came into Jerusalem for the moment just for protection. And while they're in there, Jeremiah is told by God, he says, you bring some of these sons of Rechab and set them up, line them up in front of the religious leaders, the community leaders, and put wine in front of them all and say, have a drink. Jeremiah 35. And they look at Jeremiah and they say, we can't drink wine. Our father told us, Rechab, 200 years ago, their great, great, great grandfather told them that you're going to live in tents. And you're not going to live in cities, and you're not going to drink alcoholic beverages because that's going to influence you for evil things. And they were still following their great-great-grandpa's directions 200 years ago. He's long dead. And Jeremiah lines them up, and God says to the community of Israel, look at these people follow the directions of a great-grandpa who's dead. Why won't you follow your God's directions and he's alive? And this was the message that came out of Jeremiah 35. These people were faithful workers in the community, even though they'd come in from the outside. And here they are involved in building the wall. Melchijah, the son of Rechab. So it's fun to Bible mark those things and realize all these cool connections that are there in Nehemiah. And then we have the Nethinim. These were some of these Gentile servants who, remember, they were recorded back in Ezra chapter 2. These were people that were outsiders and had been made temple servants, like sort of like the Gibeonites. And here they are involved in repairing the temple walls. Faithful people getting involved who were outsiders who had come in. It's fun to watch that God was always telling the community, look, I'm giving you the opportunity to be involved in my work. But if you don't want to be part of my family, I'll go get some people out there. You're not going to somehow like stop my project. I will fill my family. I'll just bring in others out there who would appreciate the opportunity to be involved. The disappointing workers that you find in Nehemiah 3 are people like Eliashib, the high priest. And you see right from the beginning that Eliashib, he's not really involved in the project. He built a gate with some help. They got a gate done. It was really close to, you know, where his area was. But he didn't even finish the work around his own house like the other priests did. He didn't. He just got like minimal amounts of work done. And you can see why. He really wasn't in it. Later on, he's the high priest who's allied with Tobiah. And he's the one who's connected by marriage with Sanballat. How would this high priest of Israel ever get connected with these two adversaries? He knew what they were like. He had watched through Nehemiah's time as to what these people were. But this guy is a political fella. He's a businessman. He's in it for what he can get out of it and make his life better. And it's sad, but there are people like that. And they're there as examples, I guess, to all of us that we don't want to be like them. And then Nehemiah complained about the nobles of Tekoa because they didn't work very hard. They got involved in the project. They showed up. Yeah, it was sort of like a good showing. Yeah, we're here. And they put a little bit of work. And as soon as they had an opportunity, they snuck off, you know, and they really didn't really work very hard. Or they'd ask somebody else to do the work for them because they probably thought that this isn't my kind of stuff. I shouldn't really have to do this. And what a contrast to remember what Jeshua was like. Jeshua was the guy who was all dirty in the work. He was the high priest who came back with Zerubbabel. Jeshua was Eliashib's grandpa, and he had been working and working and working on this temple for years to where he gets encouraged in Zechariah 3 and says, it's okay, the day's coming that if you remain faithful, that angels are going to change your clothes and put on your beautiful garments, and you will finally operate as high priest. And now his grandson is already gone corrupt. It's just sad to watch. But it's a warning to all of us in ecclesial life that you can't look back at your heritage. Those of you that have a Christadelphian mom and dad and a Christadelphian grandpa and grandma and great grandpa and grandma, and you can look back through the years and say, well, I've got all these Christadelphian heritage people. I've got ancestors. That's no guarantee that somehow that's going to make a difference in your life. It didn't for Eliashib, and it doesn't for other Bible characters. And those of you that have come in from the outside and you wish, well, I wish I could have that kind of heritage, it doesn't guarantee anything. Many times, some of the most enthusiastic people in God's community were outsiders who came in and appreciated what they have. I don't know if you've ever looked at the origin of Caleb. When you Joshua and Caleb, the two that actually came back with a good report, you have the Jew and the Gentile. Caleb was the son of Jephunneh, right? And he was a Gentile. He had come into the community and got connected with the tribe of Judah somehow. But the two leaders that came back and gave a good report, one was a Jew and the other one was a Gentile. And the Gentile had trusted God at that time as well. And sometimes the outsiders come in and they realize, wow, what an opportunity. Look at what you have. And those of us who grow up in the truth, we're so used to it. We grew up with Bible reading since we could ever remember. We went to Sunday school. We went to CYC. And sometimes we don't appreciate it. We're like first world people who need to look at third world issues and find out what we have, you know, and realize that, wow, we've really been blessed. So you look at what Nehemiah's motivation accomplished with God's help at this time. Look at what they did. Many of the Jewish people took up the responsibility in this case of working on the wall. Many people had a greater awareness in this case of God's working in their life. God's providence was starting to come through to people because Nehemiah told them about what God was doing. Not because they had a prophet and an angel, but because he just said, look back at the events of your life. Like Haggai, consider how you have fared and watch what God's doing in your life. And people came together to accomplish a united goal. It's fun to watch that just like with Ezra, they came together as one man and got involved in this project. And it's fun to see that this is what ecclesial projects can do. You can do this for your CYC when you get home. You can organize a project like that which will bring everybody together or to your ecclesia. You are going to be the ones that God will use to motivate your community and to unite your groups and take people that normally would have a lot of reasons to think about why they don't want to work together, and you're going to find reasons to bring them together and get involved with God's work. And so let's go home this week committed to become motivators like Nehemiah. That's what we've got to do. And don't ever give up, you see, no matter how bad things look sometimes. And you end up thinking that, well, we can't really do this. It's like there's some roadblocks there. Or you think, you go back and you think, well, these people, they didn't work together in the past. Or maybe projects we tried in the past, they didn't work. See, people like Nehemiah and Ezra, they keep coming back at it. And they come back at it with enthusiasm, not telling everybody else how bad they are, but saying, we have a problem. We need to get going. We can do this. And with God's help, hopefully, God willing, you can do that as well. And so when we leave the camp tomorrow, let's go home motivated like that to go home and motivate your ecclesias. You have been given an opportunity to come here this week. It's almost like Esther being raised up. And God's saying, look at what you have. You've been brought to this situation. And who knows, maybe God allowed you to come here this week. Maybe he provided the financial means, the transportation, the time off from work, so that you could come here and learn all these things, so that you can go home and motivate your ecclesias and your CYCs in the days to come. And hopefully we will look at Malachi in the last class.